So evolve, because creativity is connected to change, progress, sometimes evolution. Evolve has, in the technical sense, Darwinian implications. It has to do with survival of the fittest, but not just survival of the fittest by brute force. It is the development of a simple organization to an increasingly complex and specialized one. That's the point. Through interaction with the environment, so that the organism can survive against competitors. That's what evolve means, in the proper sense. It is a development from simple to more complex, and a greater degree of specialization through interaction with the environment, so that that organism can survive against competitors. And progress is an Enlightenment term, 18th century in the West. It is looking always ahead, with the implication that the future will be better than the past. Not a degeneration, but there is a tendency in our work, in our efforts, in our social lives, to improve on the past. That's what the future, that's what progress implies. You have scientific progress and so on. Now, in my work, I have likened Hinduism to a banyan tree. How many of you have seen Ficus bengalensis, if you want to give it its botanical term, a banyan tree? But the real banyan tree is my home state in West Bengal, in Calcutta, in the botanical gardens in Calcutta. What you see in front of you, is this not going to get bigger? This is an oak tree, for heaven's sake. It should be very large, but there we are. What you see in front of you is the is an oak tree. One trunk and spread out there. But this, you see the banyan tree? That is the Calcutta banyan. That is one tree. That is just one tree. And you cannot tell where the original trunk is. In most banyans you can, but not in this one. So that's why it's a good model. And it is interlinked with this canopy, the tracery of canopies. But this is one tree with over 1,000 trunks. And I've done a little bit of research. It's at least 300-400 years old, which is not very old as trees go. We have some trees in this country which go back 1,000 years. But look at the size of it. Now, compare the oak which you saw before to this. This is a better model of Hinduism. Hinduism has so many different trunks of myths, of theologies, of gods and goddesses. They function as a unit, but they're all interlinked with other units through narrative, Mahabharata, Ramayana. But when I talk of Mahabharata and Ramayana, those great epics, I don't only mean the Sanskrit versions, I mean the hundreds of versions that have developed and proliferated from the Mahayana, the Sanskrit and the Sanskrit Mahabharata and Ramayana in the south, in the vernacular languages. There are Bengali versions, Tamil versions, and across the land. So this proliferation is what unites this faith that we call Hinduism. It's a multifaceted faith, and that is a better model. Now, this is an organic reality. And through the individual trunks, which are linked with other individual trunks under this canopy, one canopy, through narration, through myths, whole lot of myths about Shiva and Vishnu and Devi, Ganesha, and all the other proliferated focuses of the transcendent. I don't like using the word polytheism for Hinduism. It is not really a polytheistic faith. It is not the same as the Abrahamic faiths, which have a different kind of monotheism, but it is a monotheistic faith. Ask a Sri Vaishnava, ask an Iskonite. There is only one supreme being. The name will vary, and the rituals and all vary, the characteristics and qualities will vary, but all the different focuses, Rama, Krishna, and so on, all of these are focuses of the One, the manifestations of the One. So it is a polymorphic monotheism. It's not my expression. It's a monotheism where the Supreme Being has different forms, manifesting in different forms. So it is a kind of monotheism. It's a real monotheism. Now, this model will give an idea as I progress of creativity in Hinduism, of the new, how Hindus visualize the new. It is significantly different from the Western mindset. Though now, of course, all of you are westernized in so many ways, but also rooted, I hope, in the Hindu tradition, those of you who are Hindus. And so you will try and understand, I'm sure, what I'm trying to say. And this is the basis for creativity in Hinduism. This model, not the oak tree. Now, there's always been creativity, the production of originality, of newness, in change, development, evolution, in various fields in Hindu tradition, in logic. Hindus are extremely advanced in logic, in hard-headed logic. And I studied the Nyaya tradition in Calcutta, where I went to university. And the logic there is extremely sophisticated and subtle. Also, Buddhist logic is very subtle. And why I mention that is because Hindu logic and Buddhist logic and Jaina logic, Jain logic, developed through dynamic debate between themselves. In philosophy, creativity. In theology, in grammar. Hindu grammar goes back to the technical texts of grammar, 4th, 5th century BC. So whilst the Greeks were developing historiography, how to write history in its early stages, the Hindus are developing grammar, the use of language, what language is for, how language is to be understood, how it is to be split up, how words are to be understood, how words are to be inflected, and so on. And you have a tremendous advance there. A very good question would be, not now, but for another conference, why traditionally Hindus have not had a very strong tradition of history and historiography. In modern times, yes, but traditionally it was more a Western concept, more a Western thing with the Greeks and so on. But Hindus have a very strong development in grammar. So there's a lot of creativity there, theology and artistic endeavor. You know that in the arts, in music, in painting, in the creation of images and statuary and so on, Indians are very well developed. And I'll come back to this at the end of the essay. Nevertheless, though Hindus have had a great tradition of creativity or creativities, the designation for the summer school is really a Western designation. The new creativity and so on, they're very Western sounding terms. And I'll try and explain more of that. Because in the West, we have been obsessed with originality. Stuff must be new, stuff must be original. We talk of new inventions, new ideas, new experiences. We want something new all the time. That's why travel is so important. That's why our technology is so developed. Everything new is coming. We give a premium to the new, almost to the point of being overtaken by the glamour of the new. But as a well-known philosopher Peter Deitch once said, I would rather be right than original. So originality is not bad, but sometimes we sacrifice what is right and true for originality. And this comes out quite often in PhD theses, which Professor Clooney and I have had to mark in our long careers. It reminds me of one examiner, PhD examiner, who wrote in his report about a thesis he examined. He said, what is good in this thesis is not original. And what is original is not good. So, we both encounter theses like these, Frank, haven't we? Yes, this is one of the occupational hazards of being an academic. So it is a good thing to be original, but it is also a good thing to be correct and right. And why there needs to be breaks, stops, for originality is something that Hindus can do very well, which I'll try and explain. So Hindus have generally been a bit suspicious, if I can put it that way, of this kind of hankering for what is new, always what is new. And it comes out in different ways. There's good thinking behind that. They have been creative always with an eye to tradition. And that is one of the, cannot generalize absolutely, but you can make that generalization. There's always an eye to tradition. Now let me draw a contrast. In Western culture, many of our ideas that we operate with today sometimes unknowingly go back to Christian origins or Christian conceptions or Christian emphases. And I want to talk just a wee bit about the Christian doctrine of creation, which I studied Christian doctrine for 4 years in the Pontifical Athenaeum in Pune. It used to be called Pune in India. And I will use a bit of Latin because we had Latin notes. Everything was in Latin. Now, creation, traditionally, for Christians, say, of St. Thomas's, one of the great theologians of the Christian church, and this is a Latin definition, creatio, creation, est productio rei, the production of a thing, ex nihilo sui et subjecti. Creation is the production of an object, of a thing, from the nothingness of itself and anything material underlying it. In other words, creation is not just a manifestation of something. Creation is not a mere appearance or illusion. Creation is the actual production of a thing after its previous non-existence. And there was nothing there for the creator to use as a material out of which to produce that thing. So from nothingness, that is the power of the creator of God in the Christian tradition. And then once that creature is created, the creator keeps it in being, and now they use another word, conservatio, conservation, to keep that being in existence. So if God chose, we would go out of existence like that. He keeps us in existence. Having produced us from nothing originally, he keeps us in existence every second, every moment, by his power, his compassion, his graciousness, his might. Now I've not traced it very academically, but I think this doctrine of creation, of producing something new out of nothing, not out of a previous material, lies historically in the group memory as a background to our obsession with having always something new, validating the new, constantly the new. We seek the new. Whether we are Christians or not in the West, whether we've lost our traditional faith or not. It's almost an elevation, absolutization of novelty. Now, there are speculations in Hinduism about creating out of nothing. You've heard of the Veda, the Rig Veda, which are one of the original Sanskrit sacred books of the Hindus. And in the Veda, in the 10th mandala, the 10th book, hymn 129, you have a hymn called the Nasadiya Shukta, which has been translated into English as the hymn of creation. Let me read you a bit in translation, which I have made, to show you that there has been this speculation in Hinduism too. So this is how the Nasadiya Sukta goes in English translation. There was neither non-being nor being then. The heavens did not exist, nor the space beyond the heavens. What lay hidden? Where? Under whose protection? Did the waters exist, impenetrable, profound? Second verse. There was no death then, na mrityurasit, nor immortality, amritam na tatha. No trace of night or day, that one, ekam, breathed without breath on its own. Other than it, there was nothing whatever. Darkness existed in the beginning, hidden by darkness. Whatever existed was covered by water. That one arose through heat, tapas. In the beginning, desire enveloped that. That which first existed was the seed of mind. Sages seeking within their hearts with insight discovered the bridge of being in non-being. Who really knows? Ko adha veda, who really knows? This is speculation, but very profound speculation. And there is an idea here of the production of being from the ekam, eva, the one only, through the power of desire, the will to create, in a very profound way. But there's no clear doctrine here that the creation has come out of nothing. The one is existing and has produced. Whereas the doctrine I told you about creation from the Christian point of view is a clear-cut doctrine which took some time to develop through the Old Testament, but which then became very clear-cut. So Hindus also have a very profound speculation about the origin of things and the beginning of the world, and almost from nothingness. But that speculation did not develop into a kind of Christian or kind of doctrine similar to the Christians. So now we have to look at the Hindu myths of creation, of bringing things into existence. Now, this is one thing you must remember when you are studying Hindu texts. Study it on three levels. The level of metaphysics or theology is one level. The level of myth is another level. And the level of liturgy, of action, of puja, of practice, of worship is a third level. Don't confuse these three levels, which are very often confused, even by people who should know better. I'll give you an example. The esteemed Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of India, a very admirable man in many respects, once said, "We don't need to learn anything from the West. Centuries ago, maybe thousands of years ago, we have perfected surgical procedures, which we have lost. You see, the god Ganesha had his head cut off, and then was fitted with an elephant head and continued to live. So we were expert at these procedures. We have lost the technique and the art." He is confusing the level of myth with the level of theology. The level of myth, how Ganesha came into being, so many things about Shiva, so many things about Vishnu, flying through Garuda in the sky and so on. There are a plethora of myths, of stories, of narratives. These are laboratories. These are laboratories of thought experiments. There is no such thing as a original myth of almost any myth in Hinduism. Because the nature of myth is to proliferate from group to group, from language to language, from time to time. So you cannot say, what was the original myth of Ganesha? You can find so many stories about Ganesha, and they all vary in one way or another. Why? Because these are ways of expressing truths at a deeper level. They are not to be taken, most of them, literally. And I'll give you an example of how a myth can be read theologically. So, what we have to do is what the swan does. When the swan is presented with a mixture of milk and water, the swan is supposed to be able to suck out the milk and leave the water. And that is what Hindu theologians do. They use the myths for their own theological ends. They take what they need, they leave what they don't need. So the level of narration, the level of myth, is a level of thought experiment, a level of concealing, masking various truths, which are then refined theologically, metaphysically. So all the creation myths are ways of symbolizing certain truths, which we then have to extract in a theological, purer sense, like milk from water. And I'll give you examples. You are familiar, do you, any of you know a myth about the creation, a myth now, not theology, about the creation of the world? Okay, who wants to give me an idea? You all said yes, but no one wants to give me an idea.
We had a talk yesterday on the churning of the milk.
The churning of the milk, okay. The manthana, the churning of the milk, producing, that's one. Anyone can give me another? This is exactly my point. You will have a multiple group of myths from which different things can be learned. Another one?
Well, we had this morning Purusha on sacrificing himself to create.
Anyone heard of the Brahmanda, the egg of creation, Hiranyagarbha, Prajapati? Look, already three. They are not. You are not to say one is right and the other two are wrong. That's not how myths work. You are to say, what can I learn from the churning of the myth? What can I learn from the Brahmanda, the egg of creation, Hiranyagarbha, the golden germ? There are more. There is a coupling. In the Upanishad you will get the male and the female coupling into different versions of the creatures of this world. There is dismemberment, the Adi Purusha who is dismembered. The Virat and the Mahapurusha, who is dismembered. So there are many myths of origin, of creation in Hinduism, and each one teaches something different. That's how myths should be treated. Not as competing things, but as so many ways of learning different ideas and truths about the origin and creation of the world. So, let me now give you an example from the how Ramanuja takes this. Well, I've got here actually one creation myth which I will read to you and show you how you can extract, like milk from water, some of the teaching, theological teachings from that myth. Now, you know the distinction between Brahma and Brahman, okay? Brahma, with a long A at the end, is a mythic character. So you have the egg, Brahmanda, the egg of Brahma. Another word for Brahma in some texts is Prajapati and so on. Brahman, the neuter, is the name for the supreme reality. Don't confuse the two, which is sometimes confused. Now Brahma, sometimes called the creator, but mistakenly so, is pictured as having four heads, each facing a cardinal point of the compass, and four hands, with the Vedic text in one hand, with a swan or goose, the symbol of discerning wisdom, in attendance. So this is a picture, this is a myth of Brahma as the creator. four heads facing four points of the compass, with his vahana, his animal mount, a goose or a swan. I told you why a swan is chosen, because a swan can separate milk from water. That is the story, it's not true. And he is in attendance with his consort, vach, or speech, sacred utterance personified, or Saraswati, the goddess of learning. So that's a picture. And then the Brahmanda Purana, the Puranas are full of myths and stories where they teach us things. This is how it describes Brahma's creation. From his first or eastern mouth, Brahma measured out the Gayatri meter, the Rig Veda, the Agnishtoma sacrifice. Then from his southern mouth, he emitted the sacrificial formulas, the Yajurs, the Trishtub meter, the Chandas meter. Then from his western mouth, he emitted the chants, the Samans, the Samaveda, the Jagati meter. And from his fourth or northern mouth, he emitted the Atharva Veda, the Anushtub meter, and the Vairaja meter. Then he measured out the verses, the formulas, and the chants so that the sacrifice may be accomplished. Then beings high and low were born from the limbs of Brahma, for he is the Lord of beings, he is Prajapati. And he emits creation's stream, having first produced the four castes, the order of the gods, the sages, the ancestors, and then human beings. This is a myth. This is not how it actually happened. And no Hindu theologian thinks this is how it actually happened. But through this myth, through these pictures, through these images, we learn that creation is something that comes from one source, that creation is measured out, that it is considered, that it is thought out, that it is not higgledy-piggledy, that the Vedas, the words, all the Vedas, the Jagati meter, and the, all these Samans and Yajurs, the hymns, came out from a transcendent source. All these are the truths you have to extract from it. And then you look at another myth, the coupling of the Adi Purusha and the female, to get some other truths. And then you look at another myth of creation to look. These are still on the level of myths, and we are extracting the theology from it. You cannot take this literally. If you do, then which one is right? But I'm coming to a point about creativity, because I'm going to show that for Hindus, in spite of all these models, measuring out, dismemberment, copulation or coupling of male and female, and so on, usually Hindus think of the production of something new from some conditions or material that went before. It is a kind of manifestation, avirbhava, a production. It's not the production of something generally from nothing. And that is why tradition is important. But I still have to come to that. Now, this is the myth you have heard. Listen to how the great theologian Ramanuja, who is a particular favorite of mine, and whom I have done some research, how he explains creation. Now, this is the theological interpretation of the myth, the first level. When the time comes to bring the cosmic dissolution to a close, the adorable one, Bhagavan. Bhagavan is a very Hindu word because it's a very personal term. The adorable one, it's more a Vaishnava word. The adorable one, having differentiated the whole mass of conscious and non-conscious being previously collapsed within him as his residual potency, brings into being the hierarchy of the powers involved in the creative process. He's not from nothing. It was collapsed in him. It had lost its form, it's lost its shape. It was his potency, that's the way of speaking, and brings it into existence. He brings the hierarchy of powers involved in the creative process up to Hiranyagarbha or Brahma, as in previous worlds, because you know there's a cyclical. The world is not the only world. The previous world collapsed, then produced a new world. The previous world collapsed, produced a new world. It's a cyclical process. Then, having manifested, the Vedas arrange precisely in their traditional order, as in the previous creation, he imparts them as before to Brahma, instructing him with regard to the production of the world in the form of the gods and humans and so on, while he himself lives in all things as their antaratma, their inner self. God does not abandon the world. God sustains the world. So though you have Brahma to carry out certain tasks, God is there sustaining the world in being. That is the heart of creation. Even in the Christian tradition, God does not bring being out of nothing and then leave it. God keeps it in being, conservatione, through conservation, sustaining it in being. This is similar in both these theological traditions. And yet, the model used in Hinduism is you're using previous material out of which God makes explicit what is hidden, what is implicit. That's a very Hindu way of thinking. So, the material is there out of which new things are shaped, then they fall back into it, then new things are shaped, they fall back into it, and so on. Do you get the picture? This is how Hindus tend to think about the production of what is new. And of course, this is shown in the Veda. Most Hindus have not read the Veda. Whereas a good Christian will have read the Bible, at least in part. And a good Jew will have read the scriptures, what Christians call the Old Testament, at least in part. But most Hindus have not open the Veda or read the Veda or know. If they know anything about the Veda, they don't know that it is the Veda because the Pandit or the Purohit, the priest during marriage and so on, is muttering something, Swaha, 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 and all that. That is the Veda, but they don't know it, some of the verses of the Veda. Doesn't matter. Because according to Hindu ways of thinking, I call this the catapulting effect, the teaching of the Veda, throughout the traditions, most traditions, the teaching of the Veda is reintroduced in other texts. The Mahabharata is called the Panchama Veda, the fifth Veda, because it's supposed to contain the ultimate teachings of the Veda. And there are many texts which are called alternative Vedas. They use the word Veda because the teaching, the saving teaching of the Veda is catapulted into these easier to understand texts. So it is not necessary to have read the original Veda because the Veda is repeated in different texts. And so the Hindus will come across it. And once you come to the great traditions of bhakti or devotion, then it is love of God which takes over and brings about your salvation. Nevertheless, the words of the Veda follow a distinct order. In each new world, absolutely the same Vedas, the same order of words, because they have creative power. And there is a philosophical tradition behind it. The words of the Veda, which are uttered in the right way, with the right inflection, the right order, have power to bring into being through their origin in the Supreme Being. That is why Hindus have tremendous respect for Sanskrit, which is the language of the Vedas, early form of Sanskrit. How often I've encountered Hindus who say, "Oh, you know Sanskrit? Oh, fantastic." Once, I'm not a Purohit, I'm a Christian. I call myself a Hindu Christian because I've studied this, and my wife is a Hindu and so on. So I call myself a Hindu Christian. She says, "Help me to understand my own faith much more deeply." Once I was asked by an old Hindu lady who had lost her husband, friend of the family, to perform the rites, funeral rites for her husband. I said, do you know what you are asking? I'm not an official Purohit. But you know Sanskrit? I said, yes, I know Sanskrit. Then you please do it for us. Because the Sanskrit has its own creative power, its own sustaining power. So I did it, because it was an act of kindness and service to that family. This goes back many years. It shows what a poor state the Hindu tradition was in this country, that they had to resort to me. They could not get a proper Purohit. Now they can. So I did it. And it was well appreciated. Story is not over. 1 month later, I got a phone call from Canada. We have heard that you did this funeral service for this old lady. I said, true? Well, we need another service. I said, I am not a Purohit. I will not do it anymore. This was an act of service for this. But you will use Sanskrit. I said, even if I use Sanskrit, I cannot do it. And thereby a lucrative profession. But this is why Hindus residually have such a great respect for Sanskrit, because it has in the Veda a creative power. So, philosophically, there are all sorts of philosophical traditions which deal with this act of renewal, of bringing something new into existence. And I will not bore you with that. You may have heard of a great Hindu tradition called Sankhya. Sankhya is one of the great traditions, one of the basic traditions of Hinduism, out of which has given many of its categories, conceptual categories, to other systems of thought. Purusha, Prakriti, this comes from Sankhya. Guna, Rajas, Sattva, Tamas, all these great categories derive from Sankhya. And Sankhya makes it very clear. All new things are modification of the original basic material called Prakriti. To bring something new into existence is to make manifest what was hidden in Prakriti. It's there in Prakriti and it is made manifest. Then it goes back into Prakriti at the dissolution. So creation is not an absolute creation from nothingness, and creation is and destruction is not an absolute loss of that object. It goes back into Prakriti, which is its remote cause. And the proximate cause is the cause that brings the thing close by into existence. So they say mustard can only come from mustard seeds, not from apple seeds. Cloth can come from threads and not from stones. But stones and apple seeds all go back into Prakriti originally, in the pralaya, in the dissolution. So for creation, for the production of newness in Hinduism, there is generally a material out of which something comes. That is why tradition is so important for Indians. Tradition in music. The sampradaya, the teaching group that you come from. The parampara, the line of the gurus. Hindus value that. They don't like upstarts. They don't like upstarts. And this is one reason why ISKCON, if I may say so, has great respect even among native-born Hindus, because they have a parampara and a sampradaya. They have a line of succession of teachers and so on that they can go back in. Whereas Bhagwan Rajneesh, remember him? Mm. Osho, eventually as he became. He was viewed by most Hindus as an upstart, coming out of nowhere, no parampara, no sampradaya. And he found it difficult to be accepted in the way ISKCON is accepted. So Hindus value that out of which something comes. And so when you talk of creativity, the lineage of the guru, parampara, the denomination, ISKCON, as opposed to a Shaiva group or something, is valuable. Because I can locate you. And you have pedigree, you have heritage, you come out of something. And so also you will get in the creative arts, in music, This was my teacher, that was his teacher. Whenever they advertised their own skills and talents, this was my teacher, this was this parampara, this was the guru tradition, lineage out of which I come. That is revered. That is respected. That is how creativity is at its best, because it comes out of a constructed past which has the weight of tradition behind it, out of which you can innovate. Out of which you can innovate. And it's a mindset that I think is quite prudent and circumspect. It's not originality for its own sake. It's originality rooted in tradition. There's a kind of basis there. Now, creativity can take different forms in Hinduism, and I want to end with my last point, because I've been told very strictly I have to stop at 4:10, and it is, I think, about 4:15. I'll speak for 10 minutes more, and then the rest, 20 minutes, we have questions. Now, creativity can take on different forms in Hinduism. Consider the sacred image. I've just been working some time on the sacred image. Pratima, Vigraha, Murti, these are all words for image, right? Archa. Archa is the image that has been consecrated. Not any old image. Pratima is just the image. Vigraha also. Murti is the form, the image. There are other words. But archa has been sacralized, consecrated image. And that archa must conform to dharma. So I cannot wake up one fine morning and say, I'm going to make an image of Vishnu. But instead of the Garuda, the great flying bird-like, I'm going to have, well, I don't know, a lion perhaps, just to be different, to be for novelty. No, it's all written. That is not according to dharma. Or Durga, lion or tiger. No, but today I will have a pigeon. No, nobody will respect that image. It has to be according. And there's the dharma of origin. So how does that image arise? And quite often, for certain images, it is called a Swayam Vyakta Murti, an image that manifests itself. So some holy person has a dream, and in the dream they're told by the god included, the god going to be worshipped, please go to this river or this stream, you will find my Murti there, my image there, that is the one I want you to worship. Swayam Vyakta Murti. Sometimes, of course, it is created in the workshop. Then you have the dharma of material. You can make it only out of certain acceptable materials. Image cannot be made. That also evolves, because when I was visiting many pujas of the goddess Durga in Bengal, where I was growing up, they were making images out of paper mache and wonderful new things like that, which is not in the sacred Sanskrit texts. So that can also evolve, but there are certain things you cannot make it out of. I'm trying to think which ones, because Hinduism is so diverse. I was going to say leather, but I actually know of some images made by a certain group where images are made of leather. So, you know, cow dung, perhaps you cannot make it out of. But I actually know now that I come to think. The texts give about 8 to 10 traditional materials, including manomayi, made from the mind, visualized images. Hinduism is very strong on dhyana or visualization practices. And if you go to the great tantric sects, but even to Ramanuja, who talks about visualizing Sri Vishnu, there is in the Vedanta Sangraha, one of the texts that he has written, a magnificent description of the image of Vishnu as visualized and as recommended by Ramanuja, which I have given. See, who says the entrepreneurial spirit is dead? Which I have given in my book, However, I tell you, do not purchase it. I cannot afford it myself. This is only for libraries and so on. When the paperback comes out, all of you rush to buy it. But in that, I've given an example of. So, in most Hindu traditions, there is the Manomayi Murti, the image that is visualized by the mind, and in blinding detail. And then that is vivified by the power of the deity so that you can relate to it. So that is one of the materials out of which images are dharmically made. Then you have the dharma of form and construction. You have to, all their iconometric texts which tell you how long the arms are to be in proportion to the legs, proportion to the head, proportion to the body, and so on and so forth. I mean, some modern sculptors can make, they try and change it, but the texts are very particular about how many angulas, they use that word. And then you have the dharma of purpose. Why are you making this image? Is it for general worship or for a specific purpose? That also has to be legitimated. And finally, you have the dharma of ritual, when it becomes an archa. It is made, and in the making process, certain rituals and certain texts and so on are said to sanctify the image. Then the opening of the eyes, then the deity resides in the image. And when the image is broken, the deity leaves. So, when you follow all these steps, the dharma of origin, the dharma, then you have a dharmic image, which you then sacralize, which you can worship. Now, she is beautiful. Chamunda. This is a ugra, or fierce form of Kali. Okay? So I don't think this is perhaps the recommended deity in ISKCON, which is more a Vaishnava tradition. But this is the Devi tradition of Hinduism. And I once attended a lecture where I got a worshipper of Kali. He brought out an image of Kali, almost as grim as this. I said, isn't she beautiful? This is my goddess. I love her. She's my mother. So beauty, it has been dharmically made. And so he brought up. I grew up in Bengal with many of these images around. And they don't faze me one bit. Because beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And she takes on these fierce forms to fight against enemies and passions and so on. But in herself, she's beautiful. There is a text in the Vishnu Dharmotara Purana, I wish I'd located it before I brought it, where it says that the Mahadevi, the great goddess, appears in the forms of Chamunda, Kali, and they give about 8 different fierce manifestations. And then the text says, just as a ray of light, the sun produces multiple rays of light, so the one supreme being produces multiple forms. This is monotheism. And the example is given, the sun producing many rays of light, and the one supreme being which in itself is pure spirit, omniscient, sarvanya, omnipresent, and so on and so forth, but comes down to us out of accessibility, saulabhya, in these different forms. So it's an act of compassion and mercy to appear in different forms. So this is a fierce form. Kali is another fierce form. There are many fierce forms. They have their own rituals, like the banyan tree, but they're all one tree, and they're all one supreme being. Now, this is how creativity is produced in Hinduism. There are new forms produced that come out of one, go back into one, come out of one, go back into one. And that gives us a sense of how we are to appreciate this. The lineage of the gurus, the tradition of that you find yourself in, the plural manifestation of the Supreme Being, the importance of tradition out of which the new comes and into which the new goes. And this is an endless process, an infinite process. So respect for tradition, respect for history, in terms of which you can be properly innovative, original, and so on. And that gives depth, I think, to the tradition. So we have 15 minutes left. Yes, there's one more image. Who is this? Shiva Nataraja. Okay, so Shiva Nataraja, this is more the Chola shape or form of Shiva. Again, you have a little demon Muyalaka at his feet, usually looking up and getting salvation. There is no concept of permanent hell in Hinduism. You can be in hell for a very long time, but I don't think... And as a Christian, I struggle with the notion of eternal hellfire, especially when God is so compassionate and loving and kind and came down to be one of us and share in our, show us solidarity and die for us. And then, of course, the theologians say, but God does not cast you into hell. You cast yourself into hell. And then you have not turned your... And then I think about it and I say, no, I think when the church talks of eternal hell, they mean a very long time, perhaps. But I don't think... I think Frank has got his own view on that, but I'd be surprised if his view was very different from mine. Because ultimately, at the end, God should be all in all, for all. And there should be no exception. But, and it may take a long time, but this is something I'm also learning from Hinduism. But the point is, this demon has, it is a demon, apasmara, the demon of forgetfulness, self-obsessed forgetfulness. We all forget where our origins are. But when we look at the saving feet of the divine being, we are brought to awareness of who we are and where we come from. And of course, this can be read out, this can be studied and read out. But when we talk now, this is a very different image from the Chamunda one we saw before. Here is image which has aesthetic beauty. Chamunda doesn't have much aesthetic beauty, but it is still beautiful to the eye of the beholder. It has dharmic beauty, what I call dharmic beauty, but not aesthetic beauty. And to understand the tradition of aesthetic beauty and the creation of things from aesthetic beauty, you have to know the theory of rasa, right? And I think you had a talk on rasa. Have you?
Tomorrow.
It's coming tomorrow. So rasa is the aesthetic sense. It is the taste of an artistic, the whole chapter on rasa in this book, so you must buy it. It has an artistic taste, the aesthetic taste, rasa. And rasa is really an interaction between the perceiver and the object perceived, the artist. And this aesthetic beauty is located in time and circumstance. So this is the Chola period, this is the Chola style, 9th, 10th century, and so on. There are many other styles of Shiva Nataraja. And again, they are pleasing to the eye. The sculptor Roder said that this was one of the finest forms of artistic representation that he was aware of. And you can then read it off and explain. It's very different from Chamunda's figure beforehand. And finally, here you have Shubha and so on. This is the Veena. Can you tell who this is with the Veena? And Saraswati and the lotus and so on. Again, another form, a modern form of a bit kitschy. But there are different conceptions of beauty. But as long as they conform to dharma, they have a dharmic beauty, which underlies these other forms of beauty. So innovation, novelty, has to conform, even in artistic endeavor, to the tradition that has preceded it. You cannot actually make it up as you go along. And that is why you know where you stand, and that's why you can innovate in Hinduism through this perception and reverence for tradition, and this respect for tradition. So I hope I've given you some idea of how Hindus look traditionally at novelty, at newness, at destruction. And now perhaps you can clarify some of these ideas that you may have through questions.
Can you say something about tapasya? Because that seems to be the creative force.
Tapasya or asceticism, yes. That is the creative force, that is connected to the Ugra form of Chamunda, right? The fierce, the austerities that you practice. And that has a creative power and a creative force. It is linked to a certain image. I have spoken about that in the book also. It's linked to a certain image of austerity, and you are able to see the veins, because you're not on the person who's practicing tapas or austerity. Austerity has a creative power, self-denial has a creative power in Hinduism, but it is always balanced with the opposite. I mean, a famous book has been written, not all of which I must say I agree with, but at least very interesting ideas, Asceticism and Eroticism in the Mythology of Shiva, by Wendy
Doniger.
At that time, she was Oflati. I think she's dropped the Oflati now, and she's Wendy Doniger. And there she shows how it is always a combination of two. It is not just austerity which gives that power. It is also the erotic, which also has power and creativity in it. And we know that Eros has the creative power of producing new life, as well as tapasya. So it is really a fusion of two, it is a balance. It is not going from one extreme to the other. And the whole point of that is the balance between the two.
Because I often find Indians to be extremely creative, even if I see them on the roadside making something, you know? And one of the things is they use this word tapasya or in a way to mean not hard work on its own, but a kind of dedication or commitment, but also this notion that you put heat on something.
Well, you're just to a, there is supposed to be a body heat, an internal heat, an agni, fire, which goes back to the Vedas. And that has creative power. That is why the sacrifice was an agni, a fire sacrifice, which produced a creative power and a creative force. And that is located or rooted in the body. The digestive system has this heat, the other system has this heat. And then it is through this creative heat, this agni, that you can produce, create new things. But it is always a balanced process between tapas and and eros, karma. And that's one thing that came out of this book, which I think is quite useful. So it's not going to extremes.
Yeah.
It's a balance, a fusion between the two.
We were looking at the Purusha Sutta this morning, and one thing that leapt out at me, I hadn't really noticed before, was as one of the categories, meter.
Maithun.
The meters.
Oh, the meters. Oh.
And obviously they're a constraining factor. Has there been a movement ever to break out from the meters in the name of creativity, poetically? I think Tulsidas, I think he says he struggles with it, or...
But innovation has been there throughout the tradition. They don't like to say it, even when they're writing commentaries of text, I'm doing I am writing a bhashya, a commentary on what the master has said. Okay, so Ramanuja has written the Sri Bhashya on the Brahma Sutras, and then his disciples will comment on his commentary. They say we are bringing out what he was intended to say. There is no virtue in saying he's wrong, and I am very rarely you will find that, and I am just countering him, as you often find in the West. No, we are bringing out, we are adducing, educhari, to bring out, adducing what was intended. The seed is there, and we are allowing it to flourish and to grow. That is the more traditional Hindu way of approaching it. So the meters, you are creative when you already have a basic structure out of which you can then exploit, manipulate, innovate from. You have this in music, you have this in art, you have this in all these forms. There's plenty of creativity, but it comes out of a tradition that exists before you. And so the meters of the Veda have got so many different kinds of meters. The Mahabharata is written in meter, the Ramayana is written in meter. And you will get subsequent poems and poets who will create, innovate, but they will have a basis from which they can do so. I mean, there may be some who want to do absolutely different, but even Harry Potter. You know, you can usually find a Harry Potter's Dumbledore and so Voldemort. They have been linked to Prospero in Shakespeare. You know, that sense there's nothing new under the sun. But Hindus actually value that and respect that and use the concept of parampara and sampradaya as part of the creative process.
I'm not interested in thinking about Orthodox Christianity, where tradition has meant a freeze in what an icon.
That is the problem, yes.
But that's different in Hinduism. You don't get that freeze.
You can, but a really innovative person will overcome that freeze. He will use the tradition as a stepping stone to creativity. But that tradition is there, and he will pay respect to the tradition, either the person who represents that tradition or the tradition itself, before he progresses with his innovative ideas and so on. And the word darkness and light is very often used. The teacher has dispelled the darkness and brought light. And of course, when you bring light on everything, you bring shape and color into the world. You bring configuration, you bring meaning, you bring sense into the world through light. Darkness obscures all that. So these are very common metaphors for teaching of something new or teaching something salvific, that you bring light out of that darkness. But the tradition is there, the sampradaya is there, the lineage is there.
On a lighter note, you mentioned the power of Sanskrit and how you were asked to do the Antim Sanskar for a friend of yours. And then you mentioned that there's no place now on earth where Hinduism is not prospering. Well, there is one. Oxford. It happened to me in March. I was called up and saying, you can read Sanskrit mantras. Can you come and do the last rites for a person who died? So there you are. You see, even Oxford, big place like that, with the Oxford Center of Hindu Studies, hasn't got a proper foothold.
Yeah, I can see Shaunaka squirming in his chair. Whether that is the reason why, or whether the time is nearly up, I'm not sure. But if I can tell you, 40 years ago, it was much more difficult. Now you can get many Purohits from London.
I know, but this family couldn't get one, so therefore they ended up with asking me to do.
But that is the redeeming power of Sanskrit, if I can use that expression. Sanskrit purifies, the text, the sutras, the verses purify, and they enable, and they give the power of purifying and making those rites work.
I must admit, I'm nowhere near as confident with Sanskrit as you are.
Well, the thing is, you just have to read the text and that's it. And I read quite a lot from the, I said, you want, what text you want? They said, well, Bhagavad Gita. Well, that was... So I read the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit and gave a translation.
Yeah.
But that satisfied that widow. That old lady.
Can I just ask, you know, in your analogy, which is really lovely, of the banyan tree, do you think religions like Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, do they come, are they roots as well?
Well, this is I developed this for Hinduism. Sikhism is quite a different faith. Sometimes it is linked to Hinduism and Jainism and Buddhism as a dharmic faith.
Yeah.
But it has quite a different structure to it. And I don't think it has the same kind of features as the banyan tree. Hinduism seems to fit that, but I develop it at some length in terms of innovation and so on. And it's a survival strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole question of sampradaya and all is a survival strategy also. And I think Buddhism has and Jainism have slightly different trajectories, but they might be, if someone does work on them, they might follow that model up to a certain extent also. But I wanted to contrast how Hindus do things with the Abrahamic faith, so-called. Even that is a difficult contrast, because Christianity doesn't neatly fit in with Islam and Judaism in a number of important respects.
Yeah.
I think this word Abrahamic faith is a rather loose expression.
Mm.
And besides, it's also male-orientated. Abrahamic faith. What happens to women, you know? So I'm not happy with that term.
Down with men. That's the purport of this talk. Thank you very much, Jesus.
Okay.